Salut, moi c'est Guillaume Hachet. Bienvenue dans 70 minutes avec. Cette semaine, un épisode qui est doublement exceptionnel. On m'a invité gracieusement à venir le mois dernier à la conférence Singularity U à Bruxelles, où j'ai pu enregistrer deux interviews. J'ai d'abord rencontré Jaya Balou, qui est responsable de la sécurité des systèmes d'information chez KPN, aux Pays-Bas. Ou plutôt, elle l'était, puisque entre-temps, elle est passée chez Avast. Elle est absolument charmante. On a parlé ensemble de cybersécurité, de Edward Snowden, de surveillance de masse, et de l'impact de toutes ces questions sur la sphère politique. Et juste après ça, vous pourrez entendre mon interview avec Jamie Susskind, qui est avocat et qui a publié un livre nommé Future Politics. C'est donc un épisode qui parle technologie, et c'est surtout un épisode qui est en anglais. Donc si vous n'êtes pas anglophone, j'ai bien peur qu'il faille attendre le prochain épisode. Je reviendrai dans deux petites semaines avec du pur 70 minutes avec en français et avec de grands invités, comme par exemple Olivia Gazalet ou bien Christophe Marchand, l'avocat belge de Julian Assange. Allez, c'est parti. My guest today is none other than Jaya Balou. Jaya Balou, you are CISO at KPN for the next week or so, because in about a week you're about to become you're about to switch over to Avast. Mm-hmm. Jaya Balou, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Could you perhaps introduce yourself for those who don't know you? Who are you? Where are you from?
So my name is Jaya Balou. I'm currently indeed the Chief Information Security Officer of KPN in the Netherlands. My background is born in India, grew up in the United States because of parents who worked at the United Nations, and living in Europe for more than 20 years. So I have
That's a very, very interesting background.
Yeah.
We're obviously going to talk about cybersecurity and all that nerdy shit in just a bit, but I do want to ask, originally from India, grew up in the United States, today working in the Netherlands, where do you feel your roots are?
This is a really good question, because I actually don't have such a problem. I believe that home is really where your heart is, and okay. I really feel like a citizen of the world, and what I really... I'm not such a fan of is this kind of nationalistic, regionalistic response we usually have. I think, you know, I identify with my species, and I would like to prefer to see myself as human.
Okay.
And belonging to this planet as a bigger thing than the borders that define us.
That's a fantastic response. I love it. As I said, we're going to talk about crypto in just a bit. But before that, Jaya, I think you're working in cybersecurity, and I think you're a woman. What's that about?
Yeah, I think there is still a male dominance of the industry. That's undeniable. However, I do think it's getting better. So you have to imagine that I have been a geek since the age of 9 or 10. I was the only girl that I knew of that had a Commodore 64, you know, when it came out, and was programming BASIC and, you know, was having fun with technology at a very early age. But it was very weird at that time. I was the only one of my gender. And that's a bit of a shame. And I wasn't actually, but I just didn't always have the means to connect with other women. And then growing up and entering the field from my early 20s, I saw that there just were not a lot of women. It is getting better today. There are more women, but it's still nowhere near 50%. So that's, I think, something to work on.
So that's a recurring topic on this show. We've had many guests to discuss this topic, but in your specific case, how would you explain, like, you escaped this determinism of sorts? Like, there is an implicit rule that says, hey, nerds are men.
Yeah.
And you seem to have escaped that somehow. Like, how do you explain that?
I think, like, you can't put a gender on curiosity, and you can't put a gender on a lot of qualities that we just have as people. I think, though, that it is not always a female-friendly place to work when you work in an industry that is so male-dominated, and you either figure out how to adapt or you rebel and do it your own way. I think initially I did a lot of adapting. And then I had something, and by the way, you said it was okay to curse. So then I had something like, fuck it. I do it exactly how I'm going to do it.
Okay.
And you know, there is...
Around what time would you say? How old were you when that happened?
I think actually the independence that I had when I was really like earning enough money to be okay and not dependent on anyone, even though I was I just got married at the time. When I was totally independent, that's when I had this notion that nothing else matters. As long as I can take care of myself, everything else is okay. And that for me was a huge liberation. What I do notice though, and I have to say this specifically for like those top functions, there's less of that glass ceiling, but more of that glass floor. So when women get a chance to get such a job at the C-level, especially in security, it's because things couldn't possibly get any worse. You know, it's because it's such a bad situation that like, oh, well, let her give it a go. And
oh,
I had
really?
To, yeah. So I think that that's almost more of a concern because that means that pretty much all the dials, all the counters are set against you to succeed. And that's a greater worry for me than, you know, this glass ceiling where you have, as a result of that glass ceiling, you have a lot of very incompetent men in a lot of these positions.
So it seems like what you're saying is that you were able to achieve this independence, this emancipation, at least at first, mainly because of your financial situation.
Yeah.
And then your career was in many ways facilitated because of what you describe as this glass floor, this idea that the cybersecurity sector was a mess and we needed strong, competent women to take care of all that.
Yeah, I think, and you know, it's also like function and organization specific, some of these things. However, once you've covered your Maslowian pyramid of, you know, needs, then I think you can actually stand up for something you believe in. But it takes a while, you know?
Right.
It's not a natural immediate response. And if it is, then you're one of the few.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like in the past 8 years or so, cybersecurity has started to make headlines more so than it did before. A big part of that seems to me had to do with the Snowden revelations.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a mix of sorts between cybersecurity and politics.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk perhaps about what's changed for your field in the past decade?
Yeah, so Snowden definitely helped. But I think the issue is, like every technology, when you have a certain amount of democratization and you lower the inertia in order to actually launch an attack, so when the actual tools of the trade become much more widely spread, when it's clear that we have governments who are engaging in a lot of the things that they were always engaging with, but now in a sort of new area of cyber, and we wake up to that, that's what changed a decade ago. A lot of people, a lot of technical folks, they all kind of suspected what was happening. But without Snowden's revelations coming out with The Guardian, before that, we didn't really know. And I think that's the difference. So suspecting of, okay, we think they have this capability. And by the way, I worked in lawful interception. I knew exactly what things were possible from a technical perspective.
Right, but before Snowden, it was kind of a tinfoil hat kind of thing, right?
It was absolutely a tinfoil hat thing. And you definitely think like, oh no, governments are good. They wouldn't do that.
Right.
Or governments cooperate with telcos. They're our friends, you know? And then you saw what happened at Belgacom. And
right.
Then you realized, okay, even the people who we thought are our friends are in this space, obviously not so friendly. And that cooperation between GCHQ and NSA, that was when I had just entered KPN. And that was a little bit mind-boggling. So I think we've learned to expect it as the norm rather than see it as the one anomaly.
Right. And so this change of mindset, this change of perspective on cybersecurity, did it have like concrete effects? Did it change the way you work and the way this industry operates?
Frankly, I think there's been too little impact felt by the revelations. And the reason I say that is because that impact isn't universal. If we are only convincing the tinfoil hatters, that small population that already took precautions to protect their privacy and their data, then that's not the population that I would say is really needed to make that impact. You want legislation to change. And take a look at the legislation in all of these countries where this stuff, these revelations came out, you know, whether it's the United States or the UK, even though there was a UK court saying that the cooperation between the NSA and GCHQ was unlawful, there wasn't really significant change in the legislation to prevent it from happening again. And we haven't really learned. If anything, we've gotten more hungry and avaricious for that information dominance than more towards trying to protect information assurance of our own states. So we're getting hungrier for signals intelligence.
Do you have an opinion on that? Like, how would you explain this passivity, this this lack of change in the legislation area? Because we've certainly seen European members of parliaments being shocked and denouncing the actions of the NSA.
But it certainly
seems like there is no repercussion to that.
Well, I think this has to be weighed with the current climate of the different geopolitical threats we're seeing. So if we see other state actors employing the same tactics, but we feel that our own intelligence agencies or our own law enforcement agencies are somehow crippled because of lack of powers they have for their own investigative things, then we don't want to have that. So we want to correct that imbalance, which is a natural need, to correct that imbalance of capability of yourself versus these other potentially hostile countries. And the rise of, you know, different terrorist incidents give a lot of public support for these privacy-limiting actions. And, you know, there's a great quote, now I'm going to forget, but someone who's willing to give up their privacy for security is deserving of neither.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I've heard that as well. Yeah,
I forget who that quote is. But, I mean, that's really the case that should be applied here. We just don't apply it with any form of rigor.
Part of that, I think, is the idea that the general public doesn't really have clear visibility on what's happening. Or it has access to this information, but it doesn't necessarily have clarity. It doesn't necessarily understand because it's a very complex topic.
Well, I think the problem really is also that people still feel, and I'm amazed by that, that they still like kind of sit in the camp of, I have nothing to hide.
Right.
Or, you know, they're not after me.
Right.
That's fine. You
or
know, it's just
it's worth it because of the terrorists.
Yeah. And to be honest, like, they're probably not after you, but that you have nothing to hide is not true, and that you are taken in the maelstrom of all of the collection that's happening, that's really the concern. And is that acceptable? Is that the type of country or state that we want to live in? I think those are like more fundamental questions to ask. And do citizens care enough to have those answered or want to know how that really works? That is sometimes the dilemma that we're really in.
There's a clear difference between direct targeted surveillance and mass surveillance, which is what Snowden has revealed to the world. How would you qualify, how would you describe the specific dangers of mass surveillance?
Well, the real thing that you have to worry about, look, and for most countries in Europe, we live in a democratic state, and there's a lot of emphasis on civil liberties, thank goodness. But I think the issue that you have to be afraid of is that in places where this type of power goes unchecked, it leads to the use of this type of data for political purposes, to suppress free speech, to prevent free trials, to follow journalists, to do all kinds of evil things that we would associate with a dictatorship. And one could argue, no, you can trust us with it because we're good, but without a checks and balance, without actually being able to know it, and that's why, you know, then there isn't mass surveillance, there's targeted lawful interception. That's why we want those kinds of privacy-preserving principles where every use of power is given by a valid authority. And that mass collection could lead to more problems than that it actually
solves. Have we witnessed cases of this power being abused?
Yeah, I think we have examples of it. And whether it's being abused by the state or whether it's being abused by individuals, we've seen examples of when the capability is available, it will be used and not always by the correct actor that it was intended for. That we've seen across different geographies in Europe. You know, it can go far back as, I think it was 2009 or 2012, but we saw the issue in Greece with the lawful intercept equipment that was kept there, where the auditing were turned off and it was being used by a host of other actors than the legitimate ones to follow all types of people. We see those powers being abused sometimes to follow particular like political parties or journalists. There was an investigation actually, I think we need coffee, but no, but we know about all types of things that are not in Europe, right? So we know about Egypt, which did this. We know about, there's a whole documentation on people who bought, entire malware kits
right.
in order to look at what their population was doing. So we know about that type of abuse. But in Europe, whether we actually know, the only example that I have like directly on the top of my mind is Greece. But I know that there were incidences of following journalists, et cetera,
right.
and other geographies in Europe. There was a report brought out by the clients of hacking software that were used to get like information from very specific targeted groups. And then and again, that was being used all over the planet.
I think it came out a couple of years ago that Uber in San Francisco had like this gigantic TV screen in their office where they were able to follow specific journalists and see which ride they were taking and so on. And so I think what people should realize is this kind of 1984 situation is what state actors have had access to for a while now.
Well, yeah, but I think, so the issue is that state actors somewhere, somehow, citizens give, there's a sort of terms and conditions we accept by being
right.
citizens of
yeah.
a state, that we give them certain powers, that we hand that over when we have an election to do certain things. And as long as that's codified in law, we understand and accept those practices. That's our T's and C's. What we don't always do is understand them well enough. Just like we say,
right.
accept for the terms
yeah.
and conditions with Uber or whatever else. You know, I think it's a different ball game when you're giving the same right of surveillance powers that you would give to a state, that you would give that to a non-state actor like a company who's providing a service for you. I don't know that we always want to accept that.
I do want to talk about this state of what some have called cyber warfare between
mm-hmm.
between states. You mentioned the situation with Belgacom a couple of minutes ago. Can you explain what happened there?
Okay. Basically, the NSA and GCHQ had a target that they wanted to follow. And that target was residing in the Middle East. So not easy to go and get a order to go and intercept the communications there. What they saw, though, was that the target was using communications provided by BICS, Belgacom International Carrier Services. So in order to get to the data of BICS, instead of going through like Five Eyes, Nine Eyes, and all types of different MLAT, mutual legal assistance things, they hacked into BICS, which is part of Belgacom, in order to get to the data of that final target. The way that they hacked into them is they used 0 days, which are like cyber weapons, if you will. But they're basically vulnerabilities in hardware and software, which the maker of the hardware and software doesn't know about. And they are then revealed in the wild
right.
with, you know, 0 days of notice for the manufacturer of those. And they use 0 days in order to compromise telecommunications equipment. And from that telecommunications equipment, they managed to intercept large amounts of data. They also compromised parts of the local infrastructure of BICS, and by doing so, managed to take this data away. And again, we might, as European states, expect this type of behavior from regimes with whom we are not on the best relations with. But the UK and the United States, this is not the usual
right.
pocket where you would expect that type of behavior. So it came as a sort of awakening, really a wake-up call for the telecommunications industry in Europe to be aware that they are also after our data.
When we're talking about hardware vulnerabilities and things that bad actors can exploit, something that comes to mind is the situation with Huawei, which has recently been banned of sorts for supposedly security reasons by the US government. It's always very ambiguous when discussing Huawei because I think the suspicion comes from the fact that there are people in the board over at Huawei who work with the Chinese government.
Mm-hmm.
What is the situation with Huawei really? Is it compromised? I own a Huawei phone somewhere in my office. Is it spying on me? Transmitting my information over to the Chinese government? What's the situation with that?
So I'm really like professionally paranoid when it comes to all kinds of hardware and software. But paranoia is, you know, it's like this, there's this quote, like, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean no one's following you. So the clue here for me is, do we actually have proof? Have we actually found something in the code when we do inspection of hardware and software from them that would point to an actual malicious intent vulnerability? And the bottom line is, although we find vulnerabilities, they suggest more sloppiness, accident, by the way, which is in all code. So anything that has, you know, a couple of thousand lines of code, there's a certain percentage which will always be having vulnerabilities. And we're trying to get that percentage down. The industry is doing better every year. But I don't have proof that there's anything wrong. And if I did, we would not allow it to be put on our networks. So we are paranoid, not just about Huawei, but also about Microsoft, also about Nokia. We test everything. And that's my preferred response as a CISO, to say, be suspicious of all of it.
Right, but also be neutral. Yeah.
Also be neutral and then verify everything, you know, and don't give away any of your trust unless you're in a position to be able to conduct verification.
Right, so based on what you're saying, based on the information you have access to, it sounds like this ban is mainly there for economical reasons.
Unless we have information that shows us otherwise, I can't discount that this is just a geopolitical move.
Right. There was also in the news a lot of scandals related to Kaspersky and a ban on Kaspersky by the U.S. government. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, so there's also a ban on Kaspersky for all critical infrastructure also in the Netherlands.
Right.
And I can be very open about this. We use Kaspersky at KPN. And so the ban was to get them all phased out of critical infrastructure. But also here, this is my same approach. We test the crap out of Kaspersky before we put them in our network. Also, we trust no one. So even with Kaspersky, what we did was we made sure that we could run it in isolation, that it would not have any type of callback functionality to wherever. And you can do that. You can have a private node, which is in your network. You can set up a data diode, which makes sure that no information goes anywhere else than where it was intended, and you can protect all of your machines, because the thing that makes Kaspersky so wanted also by U.S. government entities is because it's such a good antivirus. So if it does the, you know, the job of blocking all these other threats but introduces it by itself a sort of espionage threat, the thing you always have to ask yourself is, what is the greater risk to you?
Right.
And can you limit the secondary risk of like this espionage thing by making sure that there's no possibility for data to go out of your organization.
Okay, so was that
from this AV, by the way, I should say.
So what you were saying just now about this balance between the risk of malware security and espionage on the other hand, was that a factor in choosing Kaspersky for KPN?
No, not so much, because I think that our threat profile is not the same as every other organization's threat profile, and I think we have a very high degree of threats from espionage. So what we did is, look, Kaspersky or all other of this kind of software for a big company, it's not just a client. So you as a human being not working maybe for a huge corporation will only download the client software. But I run an organization with more than, you know, 20,000 employees, so if you want to put on every employee and contractor and blah, 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 a antivirus software, so they have access to the network, we have to have like this management console. So it's a client and a server. And this is where the problem begins, because you can test the hell out of the client, but if it connects back to a server, which is going God knows where, that's where the issue is. So what we try to do is say, okay, we know the clients are going to be on all the desktops. Let's go check them out and make sure they're okay. Once we tested the client and it said clean bit of health, we know the client gets their software updates and software library stuff or what to check for from this server. So then we made sure that we could isolate the server, not let the server send data back out even when it was downloading new update packages for all of its clients. And that's the way to actually do good security. And not everyone does it that way.
So in this case, we're talking about security for corporations, for big companies. We've been talking about cybersecurity and risks and how we're all exposed to bad actors. Mm-hmm. Is this the world that we live in? It sounds like we as consumers
are all exposed to these state-sponsored actors, to all these bad guys. Is this? It sounds like we've already lost the war. Like we were all. If anyone wants to come after me, they can.
I understand that it can feel that way, but you know, like again, they are probably not interested in you. And if they are interested in you, you might want to rethink your life change choices. You
right.
know, the clue is that
I'm very offended by what you just said.
No, but I think that we have to be very careful about what we say here about why state actors would go after particular targets.
Right.
They also don't have all these resources all over. So again, they also have to make a down select. And I think the issue here is it depends on what your role is. Journalists are actually more sensitive population, vulnerable than other groups. So yes, you would fall into that category. So you do have to take care of your security. But I think in general, most people can, if they do a few things really well, they can employ the benefits of the Pareto principle, that you do a little bit of effort for a lot of return.
Right.
And those things are things that I say it all the time. We still don't do it. Like we still don't update and patch. You know, we still don't use VPNs. We still don't have a good password policy where we have like different passwords for everything and check that regularly. Cause that's like the stupidest thing. We still click on everything.
Right.
You know, if we did like five things well, like, you know, also including backing up stuff, if we did those things well, we wouldn't have to worry
right.
about the majority of those threats.
It sounds like often we're blaming the user, like you just did now,
yeah.
like this idea that the user is kind of responsible for using a bad password, for not having the latest security patch. But it's also true that often if you want the latest security patch for your Android phone, you can't have it. Like it's often not
quickly option. Introduced. Yeah. So no, actually, I don't blame the user. So let's be very clear.
Right.
The blame rests squarely on the shoulders of software and hardware. Period. You know, including the ability to do those automatic updates and have these secure policies instated and do two-factor authentication. A lot of the times, this kind of stuff is not available. However, in the interim, between now and that moment in time, magically, where we actually give hardware software liability, so to say, you screw up, we sue you. So before that interim, I don't want people to feel powerless, to think that they've lost already. So there are things we can do now as users. We are not completely powerless, and we can set up our phones, including your Android phone. Give it to me after the podcast. But we can set it up to do automatic updates. And so when there is an update available, at least you will have it right away.
Right. But what I'm saying is that often manufacturers don't care, and they will not offer the latest monthly Android security patch.
Yeah, that sucks. And
yeah.
That is a bigger problem. And the issue, too, is, you know what I don't understand, right? We know about hardware and software vulnerabilities. We already know which products are vulnerable once they come out because everyone's scanning everything. But how come we leave those products still
on the shelf yeah.
for sale? I find that ridiculous. And we don't have this, like, the product liability that we would have for everything else. We don't have it for your choices in software or your choices in religion.
The tinfoil hat person in me wants to say, well, the lawmakers are letting these products being sold
yeah.
because they want to spy on you.
Well, I don't know if they want to spy on you, but there's certainly an economic interest here.
Right.
There's certainly the case that there's a significant lobby from all of these companies who don't want to see that liability being pushed on them, who don't want to be responsible for every screw up or hack or anything that happens to a user while that user is in their ecosystem. So I really think that this difficult place for the lawmakers is exactly where they belong in order to defend the rights of all the citizens that depend on them.
Why is it not happening then?
Again, I think that lobby is really, really strong. I don't think you can discount that. And I think that we need to do something about that, like in all other areas. But frankly, we look in every other area. I mean, these companies are not only doing bad practices in protecting consumers, they're also polluting the environment. They're doing all types of non-sustainable things. So I think we need to look a bit deeper. There's a lot more wrong than just this.
It sounds like you're in favor of much stronger legislation.
Yes.
But you're also frustrated at how little lawmakers seem to understand of cybersecurity.
Absolutely. I mean, but, you know, can I tell you, there are so many problems that I talk about that we have actual technical solutions, but the problem that we have is a sort of prisoner's dilemma. Everybody needs to implement it. And I feel that lawmakers are always legislating I don't always understand why we legislate the way we do, like the NIS directive or, you know, of a lot of other things. It's always just too little too late. And it's not actually taking into account all of the technical solutions we have at our disposal. So
right. So when are you entering politics, Jaya? When can we elect you for, the European Council?
No, I think there's other people who have a higher tolerance for
bullshit.
Yes, I it would kill me.
All right. Now, we're going to have to wrap up in about 8 minutes or so. I do want to talk about quantum crypto for a bit. Something we hear a lot about quantum is that quantum crypto is supposedly going to make our communications impossible to intercept. Is there any truth to that? Is quantum the ultimate salvation that we're all hoping for?
Well, let's peel... Okay, I know we have 8 minutes, but let's peel this onion a bit, okay? So let's first talk about why there's a problem at all.
Right.
The idea is that we are entering a new era. It's in terms of, you know, like different types of awesome computing revolutions that are happening. And this is a quantum era. And that means that we're going to be seeing advances using quantum mechanics and the principles of quantum mechanics to have cooler computers, better sensing and meteorology tools, better ways to have secure communications. And, you know, we're even going to be able to simulate quantum phenomena. So we have in Europe like this European flagship, which is working on doing all these things and trying to use those four areas for advancements for Europe. And you have to see that those areas are also somehow counterbalanced. So quantum computing, awesome. But this computing power that we will have will be also very different than the way that we use our current computing architecture, and it'll be able to solve problems that our current computing architecture cannot. One of those problems are the difficult math problems we have around our current cryptography. When it solves those problems, our current crypto is
broken.
Then broken.
Yeah.
And that's both the asymmetric, because that's really what's at risk, as well as symmetric because we have issues around key exchange and how we do the key exchange management stuff. So quantum communication is trying to use the principles of quantum mechanics to preserve things at a physical way. But we also have something else called post-quantum cryptography. That means even with a quantum computer, we have a new set of algorithms that can work all over the world on the systems of internet that we already use now. So quantum communications relies on like a new physical infrastructure. Post-quantum algorithms rely on just a new set of algorithms that need to be standardized and then taken into effect everywhere. I believe that we need both. I don't think that you can do one without the other, especially in terms of deployment scale. And this will actually give us communication security even when a government already does, you know, has a quantum computer that can break our secrets.
Right. And so those two aspects, are those going to affect consumers, or is it mainly for, again, state-sponsored actors?
No, it will absolutely affect consumers. So consumers use cryptography every day. They just don't always feel that they're using
it. Of course, yeah.
So when they do like electronic banking, or they're buying stuff online, or they're doing transactions online with their data, they're actually very often using cryptography. And what we want for the future is that still happens seamlessly and securely. The only real bet for that quantum communications thing, you know, with the physical infrastructure, that would be when it's transparent and seamless and running on a telecommunications backbone all over Europe. That's my dream, that happens.
And is there any chance of that happening, or is it just a dream?
I believe it's a very real chance, yes.
How soon?
Well...
I want it now.
Yeah, I want it also now. Well, it depends, I suppose, on the level of investment and the level of readiness
right.
we have in Europe. And this is a real problem because I'm very proud of the fact that we have in Europe a flagship for quantum. So we only have three flagships from the EU, projects for over $1 billion of subsidy. That's the Human Brain Project, Graphene, and then Quantum. So really cool. And I'm the vice chair of that thing. And it's awesome. But, you know, I feel sometimes like, can't we do more? Actually, I feel that all the time. Okay. Because if you take a look at China, you know, we do like a 1 billion project over 10 years. They're doing 10 billion per year. And they're working together with, you know, a very nice, happy consortium in China, but they have tons of money for these efforts.
The question I want to ask now is, and again, we're talking about the future. This is kind of, we're entering sci-fi territory here, but how are you hoping these new quantum and post-quantum technologies might affect things like mass surveillance, for instance?
They'll make it really, really hard. So look...
So there might be a solution to mass surveillance then?
Well, they'll make it more difficult. So we say there might be a solution, but they will make mass surveillance a lot more difficult because I think we forget. So let's say that we use quantum communications or post-quantum algorithms. Quantum communications will help you at the bare physical transport layer between endpoints to have a secure tunnel, but it won't help at all of those endpoint-to-endpoint communication. So if we use quantum communications from like the data center in Maastricht to the data center in Brussels, you can set up a quantum link with quantum communication. But that will not translate into an application layer security. So your application, unless it uses an algorithmic stack, from a user in Boston to a user in China who may be relying on this link encryption to go all the way to the application level encryption, it's not there. So what we need is security at all of those layers.
All levels,
from the physical level to the application levels in software. So,
right. Yeah. But it sounds like it might be done.
It
can
totally
be done.
It's totally doable. It's very, very doable. We're not anywhere near there yet.
Okay. We're not anywhere near there, but it is what we're aiming for.
Yes.
And it might be a very solid solution to mass surveillance, is what you're saying.
Yeah, but I think that there's still a possibility to have an attack around different parts of this solution. So
right.
I mean,
the user will always be a security hole.
That as well. The user will always be a security hole, so you can get to the traffic before it ever gets encrypted. That is always the option. But that's usually still targeted. So if you're targeting
one
user, you know, the issue is one of where are the rest of the communications happening in the clear and where can you get to a bulk of communications that is not encrypted end-to-end and node-to-node.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap up in 1 minute. I do want to ask about, it came out yesterday that Google had supposedly achieved what's called quantum supremacy, but it seems like everyone then turned their back to that and said it was actually complete bullshit. What happened? Did they really achieve quantum supremacy?
I think what they did is very impressive. So I think if I look, I read a part of that report that was coming out, and I sent it to people who are a lot smarter than me in this field, and they also feel that what Google achieved is an impressive thing. But again, you know, please don't listen to like the doomsayers, because this is basically all that negative reaction is just a little bit of jealousy, I suppose, but also a lot of game
on. Way, yeah.
You know, it's game on. And if anything, this solidifies the commitment of everybody to keep playing in this quantum race. Okay, so Google did their benchmarking of this chip. It's still awesome what they did. But I think that in order for us to go to the way of factoring something in order to get to a breakdown potentially in cryptography or using Shor's algorithm to do that, that's a way off, but it's not a far way off anymore. It's not once we will achieve that. No, this actually looks like something that's more feasible.
It's at arm's reach.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or at least it's tantalizingly seems to be at arm's reach. But again, I think that it's encouraging for the entire field.
Okay, I wanted to make a quantum joke, but I'm not going to try because it's always risky.
Oh, sure.
It's both at arm's length and not at arm's length.
I like it.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to wrap up on this awkward joke. Jaya, thank you very much. This was very interesting.
My pleasure.
Voilà, c'est tout pour Jaya Ballou. On passe maintenant au deuxième invité, Jamie Susskind, qui nous vient de Londres. J'avais découvert Jamie Susskind il y a quelques mois, puisque au moment où j'avais reçu Giuliano D'Empoli pour l'épisode numéro 24, j'étais tombé sur une vidéo de Channel 4 où est interviewé Giuliano D'Empoli et Jamie Susskind. C'est comme ça que je le connais. Et celui-ci était justement à Singularity U à Bruxelles. Et c'est comme ça qu'on s'est rencontrés.
My guest today is author, speaker, and practicing barrister, Jamie Susskind. Jamie Susskind, you are a former fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Jamie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You've recently, or I think it's been about a year, you've recently published a book named Future Politics. What prompted you to write this book?
The book is about trying to understand the profound effects that technology are having on the way that we live together. Not just how social media is changing general elections, but how artificial intelligence, blockchain, virtual reality, the Internet of Things are going to transform human society and civilization. And it struck me as unfortunate that we haven't done that much deep thinking as a society about the changes that we might be bringing upon ourselves. And a book seemed to me like the appropriate way to start addressing that.
As I mentioned, you've been working in politics before that. Have you been confronted to these topics when working in politics with Tony Blair and Miliband? Was this a topic that was surrounding you at the time?
Actually, no. I mean, I wish I could tell you a story that, you know, an issue that cropped up when I was working as, and I should say a very junior person for both of those guys, inspired me to write the book, but it's not the case. But in fact, it tells its own story, which is that the tech agenda is still far too low down our list of priorities, and it needs to be higher. It's gotten higher in the last few years because of what happened with Brexit and Trump, but it needs to be far, far higher. And in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because I was so surprised that in both my study of politics at university and in my work in politics, which wasn't for very long, but was a formative period, I found that technology was little understood and even less cared about. And to the extent that it was cared about, it was really all about how do we use tech to win elections rather than the bigger, deeper political questions posed by technology, which is actually about how it's transforming society itself.
Mm, right. That's definitely something we can get into. If we take a look at how technology interacts with politics, if we take a look at the past before we have a look at the future, it's pretty easy to take a look at the situation with, I don't know, like President Kennedy, who has, as it's very well known, very charismatic on TV. And that's part of the story, is that's what allowed him to get elected. And this kind of story is very easy to wrap our minds around. It's very simple. It one sentence and that's it. When we take a look at the current situation, something like Cambridge Analytica and how that is part of what allowed Donald Trump to get elected is much more complex. So there's definitely a sense that the complexity is much, much higher than what it used to be. Machine learning famously produces code that humans simply can't read or can't understand. We're getting the feeling that we can no longer grasp the inner workings of our democracies, of our societies, of our election systems. I know it's not an easy question, but can we ever overcome this complexity, this barrier that stands between us and our democracy?
Yes, we can. Just because technologies are complicated doesn't mean that our moral and political ideas about technology have to be complicated. In fact, the fact that a machine learning system of the kind you just described is impossible for humans to interpret might, for instance, be a very good reason for not using it in determining the length of someone's jail sentence or whether they should be entitled to a particular social welfare benefit. You might say precisely because it's so complex that the political consequence of that is that it's not an appropriate way to use that technology. And so what I try to do in my book is draw pretty simple conclusions about technologies like the one I've just described, which can guide us in their use. Looking back to the past, as you say, the trend that I identify going even further back is this, that when we have big changes in the way that we store and communicate information, we also tend to have big changes in our political structures as well. So go way back, for instance, to the invention of writing, cuneiform tablets, they were called, in the walled cities that were in what is now Iraq, on the edge of the Euphrates River. They're some of the earliest forms of writing we have. It appears that in the decades following the invention of writing, the very first empires were formed, stretching over large territories. And the reason that happened was because there hadn't previously been a stable enough way of storing and communicating information about tax and grain storage or whatever else it was until writing as a permanent medium was invented. And so the invention of this technology, this information technology, changed politics. So did the invention of the printing press. So did the invention of the internet. And so too will other digital inventions. And the reason this happens isn't that complicated. Politics is about communication. Communication is the very, very heart and soul of human politics. It's what makes it different from what animals do in the animal kingdom in its levels of sophistication. And so we shouldn't be surprised that when the way that we store and communicate information changes, the way that we organize ourselves based on that communication changes as well. So it would be naive of us, I think, to suppose that things are going to stay similar or stay the same.
One thing that struck me is when you mentioned we should not be using machine learning algorithms to decide, for instance, of the jail sentence for an individual. Was there ever a chance of something like that happening, or is that something that we only read about in 1984?
It does happen. I mean, the point I was making, first of all, was not that you shouldn't use these algorithms at all, but if you literally can't explain how a system works, then you shouldn't use it. It might be a machine learning system, might be another system. But for instance, there are courts in the United States where if you're being sentenced, they will use a machine learning system to read data about you, which purports to predict how likely you are to reoffend. And the judge, it doesn't determine your sentence, but the judge is entitled to take that into account when he sentences you or when she sentences you. And there's been quite a lot of legal upset about that in the United States, particularly because the Supreme Court of Wisconsin argued that it was lawful to use such systems, even when the person being sentenced wasn't able to access the data and algorithms that had been used in part to calculate the length of their sentence. And the American Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So yes, this stuff is real.
Right.
I mean, algorithms are also used for things like predictive policing or to determine whether certain prisoners get bail. I can't think of any society in which they are currently the last word. So they're not decisive, although they might be in an individual case.
It certainly sounds very deterministic. It sounds like based on where you're from, what your name is, what your gender is, these are things that might influence the algorithm and have an important impact on, for instance, your jail sentence.
Exactly.
Jamie, are you a pessimist? Should we be scared of the future? Is this the message of your book, that we should be scared of what the future has in hold for us?
Not scared, no. And no, I'm not a pessimist, but I can't describe myself as an optimist either. What I say is that it's possible now to see coming over the horizon these big problems, these big challenges. What are we going to do about them? Are we going to let the technologies of tomorrow develop according to, simply to market logic, getting on with it themselves? Or are we going to step in and regulate and legislate and bring them under the control of a wider population for the good of the public? If we take that choice, the latter choice, then we'll be in a good position because we'll be able to harness all of the awesome and amazing things that technology can bring us, while at the same time preserving and augmenting our democracy and our freedom and our justice. But if we simply sit back and let things take their natural course, then there's every reason to be pessimistic, because there's no reason why technologies developed according to commercial logic should also be good for society and for politics. There's no reason at all.
Part of the challenge, I think, is that most of the innovation we are witnessing in the tech industry comes from Silicon Valley, comes from the United States, which is a place that cherishes this idea of entrepreneurship, of risk-taking, of innovation, and where there is relatively less legislation, less of a tight grip on those companies by the state. From what you're saying, it sounds like you're a partisan of more legislation. Do you believe this is something that will happen?
I think your diagnosis is absolutely correct. I think that a lot of the tech that comes out of America comes out of America because of the sort of Wild West nature of the entrepreneurial environment there. There's also things like the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which makes it very difficult for states to intervene in the free market where it's considered that it might have implications for free speech. And yes, the Americans would look towards us here in Europe and they would say, Have you ever wondered why you don't have a Twitter or a Facebook or a Google? And there's probably some merit in that question. They're getting at something there. I believe that it is up to Europe, as it I think it is already doing, to propose and to show through success an alternative model. I don't think the American way is the only way of doing it. If we want to chuck all our laws down the toilet in pursuit of naked entrepreneurship and the maximization of unicorns and billion-dollar, trillion-dollar companies, then we can, but that doesn't mean we should. And so I think what you'll see and what I would encourage is the emergence of basically three global models: the American model, the European model, and the Chinese model. And I am not shy about arguing for a European model, to answer your question, which involves some regulation, some legislation, which on the one hand seeks to preserve an innovative culture and free speech and the like, but on the other hand recognizes that technologies have consequences and that some things are more important than making a quick buck. That is a very crude way of putting it, but it's the essence of my argument.
Right.
In fact, in my next book, if I may, I'll be making the case for regulation and saying, here's why we should have regulation, here's what a regulator should look like, and here's what the regulations themselves should look like. And I'm sure it will be greeted with hostility in certain parts of the States.
So Europe is certainly a challenge, but to go back for a second to Silicon Valley, how do we even get those tech giants to put themselves in question and to see the danger they can bring to our democracies and our societies, such as in the case of Cambridge Analytica? Do we have any hope that such a thing could happen?
Putting it simply, sometimes tech firms will just do the right thing. You know, Microsoft claims to follow the GDPR rules, even though it's not strictly subject to them in some respects. Good for Microsoft. Sometimes public outrage will force companies, or at least encourage them, to take a different path. I think that is the case with Facebook over the last few years. I'm not saying it's been doing a good job, but it's certainly been taking more public efforts to regulate itself. But I'm very clear about this. You can't rely on the benevolence or the wisdom of tech firms. And I do think it's a bit of a dodge sometimes. I think we
as you said, it's kind of a Wild West nature over there. So.
Right. But we underestimate sometimes the consequences that national or things like supranational in the form of the EU regulation can have. We simply are better protected here in Europe in terms of our data usage because of the GDPR than our brothers and sisters in America are. We are better protected. And I'm sure the companies in question find it more onerous to operate in Europe as a consequence. But so be it. They still do. It's a huge market. The fact that, for instance, it is very difficult to tax big multinational companies doesn't mean that we don't pass tax law and try to tax them. It just means that it's not always 100% successful. Now, I recognize the difficulties with regulating tech firms. The biggest risk is obviously always that you make one area so uncompetitive that it doesn't enjoy the flow of business that other areas might have, which is why continental-wide legislation is preferable to national legislation. But at the same time, you know, I think the German government said to Twitter, it's unlawful to show a swastika in this country. And if you show a swastika, if someone tweets a swastika, we're going to hold you responsible. Lo and behold, if I tweet a swastika in England and someone looks at it in Germany, they won't see it. If companies were given incentives to find national solutions to their regulatory problems more often, I suspect with their great genius, they would find ways of doing so.
You're saying that the changes we make here in Europe, here in the European Union, however difficult it might be, will at some point have a global effect on what's happening for our brothers and sisters in the US.
Maybe, although that isn't their primary aim. Their primary aim is to look after people in Europe. Yeah. And sometimes they do.
Part of the challenge here is that, you know, we've seen, I think it was like about a year ago, Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress, and he was being asked, how come your company is able to make money if you're not charging your customers? Obviously, that was an edge case. I'm hoping that our politicians in Europe are a bit more
tech savvy than that. However, that's definitely part of the problem, isn't it? Again, we're going back to the complexity of these issues, and we're having these lawmakers, which are often kind of the, you know, senior types, and we're asking them to legislate on stuff that's very hard to grasp. So isn't that part of the issue? Again, the complexity of these issues.
If you're asking me, do I have a great deal of confidence in the current generation of lawmakers in the Western world to produce the wise rules and laws that are needed? The answer is no, I don't. It's partly generational for the reasons you describe. I still meet politicians who will proudly tell me that they don't know how to use email, proudly. And I just sort of think, well, if that's what you take pride in, you're unlikely to be able to say much of use about machine learning algorithms. So it's partly a generational thing. It's partly a political will thing. Politicians now are a lot more educated on climate change than they were 15 years ago. The reason for that is because it's risen up the political agenda. It's no longer acceptable not to understand the science, whether you agree or disagree with it. And I would like to see something similar happening with technology. It's why I do what I do. I don't think you need to be a computer scientist or a software engineer to understand the social implications of these technologies. But you do need to have a passing understanding of them, which comes from some kind of curiosity. And you need to have a passing understanding of the literature that's been written about them. And there actually are quite a lot of smart policy types, not politicians themselves, but people working for politicians who are increasingly interested in this stuff. I have been encouraged by that, but we're nowhere near where we need to be.
You are making a comparison with climate change. There is a definite urgency with climate issues. I don't think you can say, or can you actually say, that there is a sense of urgency when talking about these tech issues?
Well, it's funny you say that. I mean, I think our generation sees there as being urgency with climate change. Right. I think a lot of people don't see it that way. I think they think, so the sea is going to rise a bit and indeterminate point in the future because of a vast aggregation of different sources of carbon emission across the planet. In a sense, one of the difficulties with climate change is that it lacks an urgency. You can't say this time next year, San Francisco will be underwater. And to that extent, I think it shares an issue with technology. What you're describing is an incremental process of change with tech, albeit one that I think is accelerating in speed rather than decelerating. And there are seldom flashpoints where things come to a head. That said, the reason the Zuckerberg was before Congress is because of a sense that there might have been Russian interference in American elections, or that Cambridge Analytica had an unwanted effect on the outcome of those elections. Likewise, there have been similar rumblings in England after the Brexit referendum, and I make no comment about that. But what I predict is you will have moments of crisis punctuated by long periods of nothingness. And what I try to do in my work is try to raise technology, albeit that it is something that is difficult to grasp as an urgent policy problem. But I want to raise it to the top of the political agenda, because if we wait till it's too late, then we'll be in big trouble.
One topic we've not been talking about thus far is the idea of privacy. 6 years ago, I think it was, Edward Snowden came forward with his infamous revelations. I don't know about you, but I don't get the feeling that a lot has changed in the, again, with the common sense of urgency. I don't see a lot of people around me worrying about their privacy being violated. How do you explain that?
It's hard to know what's happening inside the US government and whether there is a more strict approach taken to acts of questionable legality than were in the past. So I can't comment on that.
I was more talking about the broad population.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting thing that privacy, which I actually think is a bit of a 90s word, I don't find it that helpful a term, but it has never become the dominant political concern that perhaps some people thought it was. Some people might have seen the Snowden revelations and been glad that that kind of surveillance was taking place and felt safer because of it, and not cared because most of it was done by machines rather than by human beings. That is a respectable point of view. albeit that many people will disagree with it and say that it should be regulated by law in any event. But what's funny is that we have these outbursts of concern about what the state does. The real threat to privacy is from private entities, not the state,
right,
which gather data about us. And I think a lot of people would be staggered,
right,
if they were showed what private companies knew about them.
But I will say that part of the Snowden revelations was that the NSA had access to the data being collected by Google, by Microsoft, and so on. So, you know, it's actually both.
Absolutely. And the how the state gets its hands on that data is always going to be an interesting question. Does it get its hands on it commercially by buying it? Does it get its hands on it legally by requiring it? Does it get its hands on it illegally by hacking into it? These are all questions which a free society should debate about what the appropriate role of the state is in mass surveillance. I do think if most people had a sense about what was known about them, they would be surprised, though.
Right. So again, part of the issue is this complexity, the fact that not everyone understands what's going on.
Yeah, although how complex is it? How complex is it to teach someone that every time they use an app, it gathers data about their location? Or every time they take a photo of themselves for a particular app, that photo is stored in a database and used to train artificial intelligence systems, or might be sold to the government to use to develop face recognition technology to survey the public. I don't think these concepts are beyond the grasp of ordinary people. You don't need to understand how the technology works, but I do think it's all explainable.
If it's explainable, how then can we explain the fact that people seem not to care?
Well, maybe some people know about it but don't care. Maybe the fact that it's explainable doesn't necessarily mean that it's been explained.
Right.
And, you know, I have realistic expectations about what one can do. For instance, in my line of work, I write a book. Some people will read it, some people won't read it. The contents of it will be reported, but many of its contents won't be reported. Public education about a topic as big as this is a difficult thing. It's particularly difficult in circumstances where a lot of very powerful entities, be them states or corporations, don't really have an interest in public education of this kind, even without being conspiratorial. There's just no great social demand for it or commercial demand for it from their perspective. People are just trying to get on with their lives most of the time. It's the same. You can ask about any political question. Why aren't more people angry about this? The answer is because they're just trying to get the kids to school on time.
Right. Again, there is very little urgency in this case. Going back to this idea of an increasingly quantified society of data being collected about everyone all the time, could we take a second and explain to our listeners how dangerous that is and why it's problematic that data is being collected about us all the time, if that is your opinion, of course?
Right. So we generate about as much data every couple of hours now as we did from the dawn of time until 2003. And what it means is that we as individuals, leave behind us a data trail of what we buy, where we go, who we hang out with, who we speak to, what we say, what we care about, which paints a very detailed picture of our inner and outer lives, which politicians and kings and priests of the past would have been envious of. We are revealed to a much greater extent. Like, to a certain extent, it's not a bad thing. A lot of the comfort and creativity that we draw from technology, the useful services that it will provide to us in the future, will be precisely because so much data is being gathered and we are truly known as people, truly understood. But at the same time, the more you know about someone, the easier it is to manipulate them and to influence them. And the person doing the manipulator or the influencing might be a commercial entity or it might be a political entity. But either way, we are more naked to that kind of power and more defenseless to it than we were in the past. It's probably not a huge problem if we're at least aware of it and can be vigilant against it. But for the reasons we were discussing a moment ago, I think a lot of us aren't. And we are therefore endowing certain groups in society, those who have access to that data about us, with enormous power for the future, which they may well use for good ends. But should we be relying on trust?
It seems like this power, which used to be held by the states, by governments, is often now being held by these tech giants.
currency is one example with cryptocurrencies. Information, the way we are being informed. A couple of decades ago, it used to be the public broadcaster. You know, the BBC was the main way we were all being informed. Nowadays, it's a Facebook algorithm for most of us. Is this our future? Are we destined to being subjected to this power which is being held by tech giants?
I broadly agree in the sense that I think that an increasing amount of power will flow to those who own and control certain technologies. Now, that power might take a number of forms. It might take the form I was describing a moment ago, which is when people gather data about you, they're able to influence and manipulate you. It might take the form of perception control, where the slice of reality that we're presented of the outside world by our news feeds or our search algorithms is very, very slender. It's very small. And it determines our sense of right and wrong and true and false. And those who are the gatekeepers for that information, for what we know and understand of the world out there, are very powerful like that as well. And there's a third way as well that technology creates power, which is by writing rules that the rest of us have to follow. So when you try to send a tweet that is more than 280 characters, you're literally prohibited from doing so because the system won't let you. Likewise, your self-driving car might not drive over the speed limit if that's what its coders, if that's what its designers have chosen for it, whereas that's obviously a choice that you might have had in the past. So yes, I think that kind of power is being increasingly privatized. The only question remains, what do we do about it? And there are plenty of powerful entities in the world that are not state entities, but by and large, we regulate them. We require them to act in certain ways and not act in other ways that are promoting the public good. And we need to design and understand systems of regulation that can encourage those companies that hold great power to use it for ends that are not merely commercial ends.
Aren't we then playing a gigantic game of cat and mouse where a new legislation is being put in place and then Facebook has a couple of months to think of a new idea to circumvent this new legislation? And at the end of the day, the power is then still being held by Facebook.
Yes, it's the same regulatory challenge that has affected regulators in many industries for a long time. And there are other challenges, like the challenge we discussed earlier, that some companies act internationally. There are challenges to do with complexity and expertise, in that often the most sophisticated people in an industry work in the private sector rather than in the public sector. There are questions of resourcing. How do you resource sufficiently a regulator to deal properly with entities of this size? These are enormous challenges. And there's the question of timing. Technology, in particular technology being developed for commercial reasons, always moves faster than the laws which seeks to govern it. But what are you going to do? Are you going to nationalize it? Are you going to cancel it? The answer is, if you want to live in a free society, you let things happen and you try to legislate and regulate as best you can. And I certainly know that doing nothing is not an option, and there is also always a risk of doing too much, particularly by politicians who don't properly understand the problem, lumbering in and making things worse, or indeed, you know, the risk of what commonly happens in the United States, which is that a nice, charming person from a large company turns up and says, "Don't worry, you don't need to understand this. I've written the regulations for you." And then the senator says, "Oh, yes, that's very useful. Thank you." See, for instance, the financial sector. So we need to avoid all of that. I don't deny it's challenging and difficult, but I think what's useful is that we are even conceiving it in political terms. That's half the battle.
We're going to have to wrap up in a couple of minutes. One of my first questions to you was, Jamie, are you a pessimist? To which you said, I don't think so. As a final question to you, can you come up with a series of examples of how technology actually drastically improves or is about to drastically improve our lives, something that specifically in terms of politics, something where the future of politics is actually bright thanks to technology?
Well, look, I can, Guillaume, but what I would say is this. There are plenty of people out there banging the drum for technology. Plenty of people saying it's going to be a great thing and transform our lives in amazing and beautiful ways. And already we look around us and we see our lives transformed, the way that we do commerce, the way that we do romance, the way that we do education, the way that we play games. These things are all being improved. And
those are not related directly to politics. When it comes to the field, the future of politics, which is the name of your book,
yeah.
In which case, is it actually a bright future?
I'm going to give you the same answer. I mean, I wish I could just say, here are all the ways that technology is improving politics. But my sole central thesis is that technology is transforming politics, and the effects are by and large not benign. They're not good, because we are letting politics develop according to the logic of the marketplace rather than the logic of the forum or the logic of politics itself. So what we need to do is get onto the playing field and start making sure that technology is engineered in a way that makes us more free, makes society more just, redistributes power, and improves democracy. Because I think if you just leave the systems to themselves, I do think they will corrode those.
Jimmy Suskind, thank you very much.
Voilà, c'est déjà tout pour ce 27e épisode de 70 minutes avec. J'espère que c'était digeste, j'espère que le changement de format ne vous a pas trop dérangé. Comme je le disais, on revient dans deux petites semaines avec du 70 minutes avec pur jus, puisque je recevrai Olivia Gazalet, avec qui on va déconstruire ensemble le mythe de la virilité. Ça devrait être un épisode dans la lignée de ce qu'on avait fait par exemple avec Julie Dachet. Enfin, j'espère en tout cas, on verra comment ça se passe. À très vite, salut.